Ladies and gentlemen, with that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for February the 2nd, 2016.
Groundhog Day.
And?
You said that yesterday.
This is really the real Groundhog Day.
Every day here, Madam Co-Chair, is Groundhog Day.
We are here for the purpose of some informational meetings and a work session on three items, and I am going to ask Mr. Bender to start us off, including a comment on a change in the batting order on the agenda. And so, Mr. Bender, if you could start with some introduction for the committee for the short session.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and subcommittee members. I would like to just speak briefly about the work plan for the subcommittee this session and what we're anticipating. In terms of the Senator Johnson mentioned there is a change in the order for today's agenda. After this informational meeting, which is the overview of the subcommittee work plan, you'll be moving on to the first item, the report on the merger of the Insurance Division and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities in DCBS. Then moving on, skipping over, essentially the Jordan Cove presentation will be put last at the bottom. So that would be the change. That second one will be moved to the bottom to accommodate people's schedules. But I just would like to mention that during the short session, the subcommittee's work is quite different, or significantly different than what it is during the long sessions. During the long sessions, your primary responsibility is to approve budgets for the 12 agencies that are assigned to you. In this case, because budgets have been adopted, your activities will be somewhat different. Before I go on, I would like to just point out that we have uploaded a list in OLIS under today's meeting date. It's the last item on that list. And what it is it looks like this. If you look at it, it's a list of agency and LFO analyst assignments for the session. If you have any questions about particular agencies, this list will be helpful to help you identify the analyst who will be able to assist you with questions about these particular agency budgets. I mentioned that you have 12 agencies assigned to the subcommittee. Currently, we're expecting 9 of these to come forward with various reports or requests to you during this short session. The other 3 that we're not expecting you to hear from are, which are BOLI, PUC, and the Racing Commission. We don't know of anything that they'll be coming up with as of now. They may come up later if there's a policy bill, for instance, which affects their budgets and is assigned to the subcommittee. Because you're not adopting agency budgets this session, you're basically will be doing, this affects both the content and the process of the subcommittee's work. What you will be basically asked to consider are adjustments to existing agency budgets. You'll be asked to consider requests of agencies to apply for federal grants. And there will be instances where you'll be asked to ratify fees that's under statute. The agency will not be able to impose unless they receive legislative approval or ratification of those fees. And there'll be a series of reports that will be presented to you. There also will likely be policy bills that will come to the subcommittee, as in the long session, policy bills that affect the budgets of the 12 agencies that are assigned to the subcommittee. We don't have any now, but they would tend to likely be assigned during the second half or the latter part of the legislative session. The process is slightly different in the sense that because you aren't approving budgets, you don't have budget bills assigned to the subcommittee. The way that that affects the process is that we will be scheduling items for work session or for informational meetings. We can only schedule a public hearing if there's an actual bill. And since we don't have bills, we won't be posting public hearings. However, it will, and generally we'll have invited testimony for these items. It will always be the prerogative of the chair, whoever's chairing the subcommittee, to open it up to public testimony if that's ever if they would ever like to do that. But the posting will generally be informational meetings and work sessions. As with work sessions in any regular session, we will be, when something is scheduled for a work session, the subcommittee will eventually take a vote, and a quorum will be needed in order to open that work session and to record the vote. We are expecting at this point there to be at least one work session on every meeting of the subcommittee. So it is important. We urge you to be in attendance, and if for whatever reason you need to be asked to be excused, please let the co-chairs and LFO know prior, so that if it's necessary to adjust the order of presentations in a subcommittee to accommodate that, we can do that. Again, one other difference is in many cases, actions that you approve will not be going to the full committee for a separate vote. And that's somewhat different than what normally happens during a long session. To be specific, to give a specific example of this, if an agency is requesting an adjustment to their budget, you will be asked to review that. You will be asked to either recommend it or not recommend it or recommend something different. Whatever you recommend will then be put into a omnibus budget reconciliation bill. Yeah. That will then be voted on in full committee as a whole, but there won't be a specific presentation on that item. Members may discuss any item in the bill when it comes forward in full committee, but it won't be a separate item in a separate vote. I would just like to mention that your committee assistant this session is Dorothy Deal. We're very pleased to have her. She worked at the Legislative Fiscal Office several sessions ago, and we're happy and pleased that she's able to come back. If you have any questions, let her know. She'll be here every day in the meeting. We have tried to organize things so that we have one agency per day or two agencies per day, as opposed to a lot of different agencies coming up. Today we have DCBS, and unless there are any questions.
I do have a specific question regarding, is there a limit to the amount of money if an agency needs additional funds? For example, what I have in mind is if MOTA goes under and the state of Oregon has to pick up several million dollars or tens or hundreds of millions of dollars or whatever, and we recommend that and it goes into this general budget bill at the end, is there a limit to how much we are going to decide needs to be in this budget bill?
The full committee co-chairs, as they would in a regular, as they would in one of the longer sessions, are looking at the availability of general fund and lottery funds to ensure that the total expenditures don't exceed the amount of funds available. So they will be looking at this on a budget-wide basis, looking at items that come before all six subcommittees that look at operating budgets. So the co-chairs here of the subcommittee will be getting instructions from them as to information that may be able to be funded or not funded in the budget. And of course, as always, LFO will not be recommending expenditures that the co-chairs have determined they don't have enough money to spend. So it will be a similar process in that sense to what is done in order to assure a balanced budget during the odd year sessions.
Senator Hansel.
Mr. Bender, from what I think of, from what I heard you say, that if a person has to testify on a bill, that I should let the co-chairs know before the meeting, which I will do in the future, but in the meantime, I got to go testify on a happy candy bill.
That's fine. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bender.
Thank you very much.
Noted for the record that Senator Hansel is excused. So we will begin the presentations. I will invite Mr. Allen to come forward. and we're changing LFO staff. Mr. Stainer, welcome.
Thank you.
And anybody that you want from Team DCBS.
Thank you. And did you want Mr. Stainer to tee it up, or should I dive in?
I think you should go in, but it's up to you.
I'm fine. Yeah. Dive in.
Thank you very much. My name, co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. First, I appreciate your indulgence in arranging schedules, and I should also explain that Laura Calley, who is the administrator of the new Division of Financial Regulation, was supposed to be here with me. Her job duties include being the state insurance commissioner, and so she's otherwise occupied, and appreciate your indulgence on that as well. If I've lowered the bar far enough, go ahead and dive in a little bit to talking about what it is we have done. And why, and what we expect to get out of it. And as was mentioned at the very beginning, effective more or less, and I'll come back to that, January 1st, we have taken the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities and the Insurance Division and merged them into a single Division of Financial Regulation. I want to, there's very little that I actually have in the way of a PowerPoint. I know you'll be disappointed to hear, but I've got some sort of before and after org charts, and I want to show you the before org chart for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, because I think it's illustrative of what we've been trying to accomplish. If you look across the bottom of that, you'll see functional areas of the division that really describe types of business entities, banks and credit unions, or banks and trusts, credit unions, mortgage lending, and so on. Some of you know I began my career probably 30 years ago in the banking industry for about a decade. In the banking industry, when I worked there in the 80s, banks were in a different line of business than credit unions, which were in turn in a different line of business than insurance companies. If you look at those entities today, banks, credit unions, insurance companies all take deposits, all make loans, and all sell insurance, every single one of them. The industries that we regulate do not line up in these neat silos that are self-contained and are a single defined line of business. And we exist as an agency essentially in the regulatory form that we were first created in about 25 years ago. When I've had conversations with folks in the financial industries that we regulate, one of the questions I've usually asked is, if your organization is in its exact form, the exact same form that it held a quarter of a century ago, would you please raise your hand? And of course, nobody does. The industries that we regulate have changed significantly. Often, an organizational change in an agency stems from a breakdown or a problem or an identified set of things that aren't working right. And that's fundamentally not the case, I would suggest, at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I think we're an agency that does a good job at its mission. But it's increasingly clear to me that our organizational structure is increasingly out of date from the way the industry actually operates day in and day out. And so what we have done is try to create an agency that is geared toward regulating the financial services industry and is able to pay attention not so much to the type of a charter or type of a business that who we regulate is in, but pay attention to those on whose behalf we regulate. People live in not in silos of bank customers or credit union customers or insurance customers. They live in broad definitions of senior citizens, students and young people, poor and economically minimally attached, those kinds of things where they've got a variety of circumstances that they may be subject to, risks that they face, ways that they can be taken advantage of, and we want to be able to look holistically at those kinds of problems. And so what I'm showing you now is the new organizational structure for the Division of Financial Regulation. And if you look across, the middle row is really the important area. It really describes what we do, not in terms of who we regulate, but in terms of the regulatory work that we do. And so we will have created a consolidated shop that does policy and rule development and actuarial services, a compliance unit that focuses on our regulated entities following the consumer protection rules they're supposed to follow. A concentrated investigations and enforcement unit. I want to come back especially to that one. I also want to come back to consumer education and advocacy. product regulation, financial institutions, and licensing. Financial institutions is really the safety and soundness function of what we do. How do we make sure that whether it's an insurance company or a bank, for example, that they're operating appropriately, that they're meeting the various regulatory standards that differ from industry to industry for safe operation of those institutions. Let me talk for a minute about investigations and enforcement and about consumer advocacy and education, because I think they really illustrate what we think is some of the delta or addition of what we get. As you probably know, in insurance, we've had a consumer advocacy section for a long while. That's about a dozen people who specialize in taking calls from people who are having issues with their insurance company or insurance policy. We've even done some promotion of that work here over about the last year and a half. And they have a really good track record of being able to deal with a consumer, listen to what their problem is, and then help them get the help that they need. That may be nothing more complicated than explaining their policy to them so they understand what's just happened in a transaction. It may be a soft level of advocacy with the insurance company. A great example is someone will call, and I think this is even on one of our ads, that the insurance company totaled their car and they don't think it should be totaled, and we can call the company and say, hey, would you take another look at this, and we can do some of those advocacy work on their behalf. And sometimes it escalates all the way up to actual enforcement work. We'll discover through that a pattern or practice of problems at a particular company or across an industry and be able to move to higher levels of regulatory work. That package of tools that is successful at getting millions of dollars back for Oregonians that they're entitled to on their insurance policies doesn't really exist in a formalized way currently in any of the other financial service areas we regulate. We certainly do that kind of advocacy, but it's very much siloed in program staff involved in mortgage lending or program staff involved in banks or what have you. I think one of the big opportunities with this structure is to consolidate that work and broaden that approach to consumer advocacy across all of the financial services sectors that we regulate, because people don't need help just with their insurance company. They often do need help with their bank or their mortgage lender or other entity that we deal with. And so we think that we'll be able to significantly expand the work that we do, not by devoting a ton more resource to it, but by taking scattered bits of resource across the organization and concentrating them in that fashion. Similarly, in investigations and enforcement, we've had pockets of that work done associated with various programs, and we believe what we'll be able to do is consolidate that work into a single investigations and enforcement shop and really be able to, if you'll pardon the use of the phrase, apply some prosecutorial discretion to the kinds of things we pursue. Where do we put our resources? What do we go after? What kinds of circumstances do we pursue so that we can scale the use of that resource to things that are causing big problems or are widespread or need particularly focused attention? And we think that's a much, much better approach to doing this than having it be siloed and, coming to work thinking I do securities law and securities law is what I do. I do insurance law and insurance law is what I do, and be able to think more broadly about those populations. Now, in terms of what I've just talked about, kind of the obvious question that comes up is, well, it's great that we're doing these functionally, but these are all dedicated statutorily dedicated funds. What's the financial structure that lies behind this? You've all, I know, dealt with our budget before, and you're familiar with the Building Codes Division, which it really has a similar structure to what we're applying here. We'll be using what would effectively be kind of a matrix approach to this work. You'll have functions down one side of the matrix and dedicated funding sources across the other. And so we'll need to allocate and account for the work in the enforcement section that's done related to mortgage lending, make sure that mortgage lending fees are not being used to subsidize work being done for credit unions. But we have extensive experience with that kind of a structure. And so we'll be able to maintain our statutory dedication across our funds, be able to demonstrate that to stakeholders and to you, but be able to manage the work in a flexible fashion that allows us to better meet the needs of Oregonians. I think the last thing I would want to touch on here before I see if there are questions that you have is I've described this to our stakeholders and others as really a body of work that's around effectiveness first and foremost and a bit of efficiency. I think this will be a more efficient way to do work over time, but really it's about how to do the work better. Our mission is to serve and protect consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate. It's really about how to achieve those kinds of outcomes better and not fundamentally about where can we find positions to get rid of because we think that we're overstaffed. We have people who are doing good work who are plenty busy. This is about how to help them be more effective at that work. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions you might have.
Colleagues, questions? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being here, Mr. Director. I was particularly struck by your description of the benefits of breaking down the silos between the context where the advocacy and education work happens. I wonder if you could I found myself sort of imagining different scenarios, but I wonder if you could give us a couple of examples of the sort of thing that could fill in some of those details for us.
Sure, on the advocacy side?
Yes.
Yeah, I think we're in a different place today than we were 5 or 6 years ago, but 5 or 6 years ago there were plenty of people who were having problems with mortgage loan servicing. There are still plenty of people, but not on nearly the scale where it was crisis levels. And I think we did a credible job trying to deal with those at that time, but the ability to have a group of people who are flexibly able to be deployed across a wider array of topics is really important. Now, for my employees at home who are listening to this, I think we'll always have specialization within the agency, but I think there's also lots of room for the ability to skill people up on a variety of topics and be able to deploy them to where a crisis need is occurring. I'll give you an example right now that's a little bit off point because of the nature of how we've dealt with it, but obviously, MOTA has been in the news, and among other things, we have an 800 number up for people to call with questions and concerns. We've got the dozen staff that are involved in consumer insurance advocacy, and we have augmented that staff internally with folks who do injured worker ombudsman work and workers' comp benefits, people who are used to taking calls in on the phone and basically add to the resource so that we're able to accommodate a higher volume of calls. That does remind me of one other thing I forgot to touch on, which is our implementation of this structure is on something of a rolling basis. We put pieces of it into place on the 1st of January. The top-level administration of the division and a couple of the units will be putting the rest of the boxes of the org chart in place over the early part of 2016, and then truly integrating the divisions will require a set of projects to actually do that work. Let me give you one very simple example. Right now, the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities and the Insurance Division have separate processes for how they process travel claims. No problem with that, but in this division, we're going to have one process, and it really doesn't matter if it's one of those two or a third one, but some group of people is going to have to sit down and figure that out and then decide what that process is. There are hundreds of things like that, from that simple to much more complex, that will be necessary to truly integrate the divisions. Now that I've totally changed the subject, did I answer your question?
Quite well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. So, Mr. Allen, I in my head, I'm trying to articulate a principle to myself, and I'm kind of uncomfortable with the idea of the government being an advocate, running an advocacy operation, and then to kind of piggyback on that, kind of a similar thing is then the government advertising the availability of those things. And I've seen your billboard ads for my insurance company thinks my car is totaled and I disagree and all that. And I wouldn't even say I'm necessarily against it. I'm just kind of uncomfortable with it. And I think that maybe, in some ways, the government does have a need to advertise. Like I can think of like a state park or something like that, or we're doing a lot of new marijuana law and things like that, so that we need to get that information out to people. But I guess I'm kind of wary of a government that's being an advocate and then advertising those services. So, for instance, if there's a problem with the insurance company telling the guy that his car's totaled, I think it's maybe the responsibility of the legislature to, make something illegal or to regulate things somehow, and then you step in as an enforcement person. And then when I hear government as an enforcement person, that's something that seems to me to be kind of more of a government, a thing that government does on many levels. And so I'm kind of more comfortable with that. And so what would you say to someone like me who's uncomfortable with government as an advocate, especially someone who, let's say, values small government?
I appreciate that. Co-chairs, Representative Nierman, it's a great question. And believe me, before we headed down the path, particularly on the advertising side of doing that, I asked exactly those same questions and share some of that same concern. And advocacy is a word that we periodically chase around a little bit to see if it's exactly the right word. But let me tell you what I think the alternative is in not just insurance but in financial services to that kind of work, which is calling a regulator who says, I'm sorry, I can't advise you on the nature of your policy. You need to call a lawyer. And pushing those folks to get an attorney and take it up with their insurance company or bank or whatever through that means. We think that what we provide is a valuable alternative to resolve lots of circumstances that really don't have to do with something that's a violation of the law. They have to do with a miscommunication. One of the reasons that we might want to be able to talk to the person who thinks his car has been totaled, who might want to change the law, is because he may be wrong. He may need some help looking at the policy and having explained to him why what just happened in that transaction is actually what the policy says. Maybe that at a very soft level, we're able to call a company and ask some questions and understand what happened and explain that back to him, or get them to take a second look at a situation that really is a gray area. And in a lot of these circumstances, a lot of this is interpretive gray area kind of work. And so I agree with you that advocacy may be the wrong word, and especially coming from a political context. But it's really that notion of how do you reduce friction in the system so that it works the way everyone expects it should work, and we actually reduce the need for enforcement actions or reduce the need for changes in the law, because all we're doing is helping people operate within the law in a way that tries to meet people's needs. Is that at all helpful?
Thank you. Can I follow up,
Representative Nierman?
Your list of things that you're eliminating, and also the need for the guy to pick up a phone and call a lawyer and all that. Nothing against lawyers or anything like that. But I know you don't have hard numbers in front of you, but how much percent of your energy is spent on advocacy and advertising and those kinds of things? Is it small or big?
That's
or
very
growing or
yeah, co-chairs member Representative Nierman, it's very small right now. Before we make changes that are in line with this organizational structure, it's about a dozen staff out of 930 who are involved in this function. From a budgetary standpoint, it's the advertising budget is, I should probably get you back a more specific number if you'd like, but I want to say it's a couple of million dollars out of a $200 million biennial budget. So we're talking about very small incremental amounts that are involved in this.
If you do have numbers,
certainly can. Yes,
thank you.
In the queue, Representative Gomberg, then Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. A quick question and then a comment, if I could. Thank you, Director Allen. I've been asked questions about your advertising account. Am I correct that the funds expended on that don't come from our general funds, but rather come from insurance company fees?
That's correct.
And my comment is this, with great respect for the observations that Representative Nierman is offering, I have a slightly different perspective this week. And we've had more than our share of water out on the coast the last few weeks. And as a consequence, we've had communities that have been completely cut off. I've got constituents whose garage disappeared into a sinkhole. Another group of constituents whose roadway and driveways were completely eliminated by land movements and their houses are unusable. I've got another constituent who lived downhill from a pond, and a landslide went into the pond, and the pond went into her basement. And one of your insurance advocates was kind enough to come out and do a couple of meetings, one in Lincoln County, another one in Tillamook County, and met with people who had personally encountered these kinds of situations and were finding no solace from their insurance companies. And while the results may not have been entirely different at the end of the conversation, I have to say that your advocates really gave them some hope and some sense that somebody was listening and paying attention, and gave an entirely different meaning to the phrase that I'm from the government and I'm here to help you.
Well, thank you for mentioning that, and it reminds me this past summer, of course, with the wildfire situation in eastern Oregon, it was these same staff that we deployed out into the field in Grant County and elsewhere to do town hall forums and individual meetings in community centers with folks to help them deal with questions that you wouldn't ordinarily think, maybe from our perspective of we had a fire and the home place is covered, but the bridge across the creek to the outbuildings, is it or isn't it covered? Are the fences covered? Well, it depends whether they're fencing pasture or fencing the home place. That's the kind of stuff that our staff was able to go out and help people resolve. We were also able to work with the insurance companies that were involved, many of which had requirements that reconstruction occur within a year, which in rural Oregon is incredibly difficult with a large volume to get that kind of work done that quickly. And they were able to work with companies to get forbearance on the timeline, and I would be remiss if I didn't also mention that part of one single department focused on these missions, the Building Codes Division, which is also part of DCBS, worked with local building departments to come up with some flexible code interpretations and ways to deal with the resultant building code implications of those fires and reconstruction. So thank you for reminding me of that.
So, Representative Whitson.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to MOTA just to ask.
Certainly.
If you could provide each member of the legislature with a 1-800 number for people to call. The single greatest number of emails I am now getting are from senior citizens with supplemental insurance through MOTA and the individual and group large group policies, and it's just sort of seeping out into the public right now what's happening, and they are worried, and I have not known that there was a number till just now. So there is an 800 number.
Yes, thank you, Coach.
It would probably help all of us getting these questions.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chairs. Representative Whitsitt, if you don't already, you should very soon be getting in your email inbox an email from me that includes some basic talking points about what's going on and what people need to know, the reference to the 800 number, as well as a link to a questions and answers page that we have up on our website to be able to answer some common questions that people have. Now, you do need to know we're at a preliminary stage of the circumstance with MOTA, and there are a lot of questions that people have that we won't know the answer to for a bit, like what's going to happen to my deductible or the plan that I have, or can I see my doctor, and those kinds of things. And there will be some frustration with getting through to us and what we can and can't tell them. That will improve and change over time as we work our way through the situation, but I want to make sure people understand that.
Okay.
Follow up.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And we have people who are scheduled for surgeries. We have people who have doctor's appointments, and they're worried. And I've been telling them, just don't do anything. Don't not pay your premiums. There are a lot of people paying monthly premiums. I just kind of want to understand if you could just sort of tell us what they need to do or not do.
Yes, absolutely. Co-Chairs, Representative Whitsitt, that's exactly right. MOTA insurance policies are in force, and they are paying claims, and part of why we're on site monitoring and supervising the companies to assure that that continues to happen. So you're exactly right. People should continue to pay their premiums. They don't want their insurance to lapse, and they should be able to continue operating because it's true that those policies are in full force. There could be changes in that circumstance over time. We're working very hard to make sure that whatever the future looks like, the transition to it is as smooth as possibly can be, but it's way too early to speculate what that might be.
I'll look for, thank you very much. I'll look for that in the next few days.
Hours.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Colleagues? I have one for you, Mr. Allen. A couple of us on this dais spent the morning interacting with an agency and the people that it regulates, and it was not a happy meeting. You are making some structural changes in your organization. What has been the reaction of the regulatees?
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. I was actually prepared for a lot more skepticism than we received. I got to say, starting out by asking people if their organization has been unchanged in 25 years probably helped. But uniformly, stakeholders have told us that while they will be keeping a careful eye out for the interests of their industry, they think that what we're doing makes sense and is logical and should be more effective, and they have been very supportive.
Thank you. Thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg, I have to step out for 2 seconds.
Mr. Allen, did you have more that you were going to share for us before we move into our work sessions?
I think I'm fine. Would you like me to remain here for the work session since they're on our materials?
We just in case. Any other questions before Mr. Allen leaves the dais? Mr. Stainer. Well, that's a problem. We could call you Senator and just move along. But all right.
That wouldn't be very nice to him.
I have one last question.
Ask away. I'm sorry if anybody listening in wasn't clear on exactly what just happened. We're ready to move into work sessions at the same time that we just lost our quorum. So we're just going to stretch things out for a moment or two.
I can vamp as long as you'd like.
Representative Whitsitt, please.
So the consolidation of this, will it change any laws presently on the any statute or administrative rules that you have on the books now by doing this? It seems like you're taking perhaps two very large agencies and putting them into one. So what are the ramifications in terms of statutory change if we agree to this?
That's a great question. Thank you, Chair Gomberg, Representative Whitsitt. The organizational change itself does not require legislation. The only thing really that exists in statute is the department and the director, by and large. Our structure below that level is at my discretion with the approval of the governor. However, the agency administers things that are discrete pieces of statute. So the insurance code is a thing in statute, and we would not expect any kind of a change. There will always be an insurance code. How we administer that is what's changing, not the code. Same thing. There's securities law. There's bank and trust law, and so on. From an administrative rules standpoint, of course, there will be some mundane things where there will be name changes that occur periodically over time. I would hope that there may be some changes in how we adopt and administer rules in reflection of this, because part of what we want to do this work more effectively. But I would say that in the main, you should not see a wholesale change to those kinds of things. And I don't believe anything out of this will require us to bring you a bill. There would be a change in the 17-19 biennium, potentially, with our budget structure, because right now we have budget structures that line up to our divisional structure, and presumably we would propose to change that. But again, because we're not disturbing statutorily dedicated funding sources, they continue to be dedicated to the work they're dedicated to, all those kinds of things. Most of those fees are statutory. We don't anticipate changes there. I think you'll see this a relatively small profile of impact here at the legislature.
Further questions?
I tried to make that answer as long as I could for you.
We'll be the entertainer here. Where's your name up
there? Well, thank you, Chair Representative Whitsitt. This is the piece of the agency that does this work. There are pieces of the agency that do occupational safety and health, workers' compensation, building codes, and my name would be above the boxes for those functional areas.
Will you be under this division then?
I'm above it.
You're above it. Okay.
Yes, this is one of the units that's within the department, and I'm the director of the department.
Okay, thank you. All right. Sorry.
No, that's fine.
Well, Director Allen, a question that you probably didn't anticipate, but many of us here are becoming increasingly interested and concerned about the amount of delinquent accounts that various agencies are carrying. Mm-hmm. And there's a sizable amount on the ledger for your department. Mm-hmm. I'm looking back to the most recent report we have is from 2014. We don't have the 2015 report, but at that time there was more than $50 million in delinquent accounts with your department, and you're going to be appearing before us later, and I could just take this opportunity to warn you we'd like to hear a little bit more about that, or if you wanted
to. Well, I can certainly speak to that briefly now.
I've got a quorum now, but sure, let's take just a moment on that fascinating
sure.
$50 million question.
Sure. So the body of accounts that we collect are made up of a number of things. There are a couple of things to be particularly aware of when you look at that dollar amount. One is civil penalties, and there are civil penalties that we will assess often to make a point rather than to try to collect money. Let me give you an example. There are any number of cases where we've caught somebody running a pyramid scheme or in some other way defrauding people. And typically, as a part of pursuing that, we'll find them some exceptionally large amount, $1 million or something like that. The point isn't to get $1 million out of them. The point, frankly, is to get the $1 million fine to be the first thing that shows up on a Google search when someone is in checking their background to see if they want to do business with them. We want to be able to get that, the fact that they have been found in serious violation of securities law or whatever it is on the books. And those, not surprisingly, are exceptionally difficult to collect. The second is we're responsible for collecting money related to non-complying employers in the workers' compensation system. In that case, there are a couple of things that drive that. There are very serious civil penalties that go with non-compliance with the system. But also, if you have tried to be a free rider, operate a business with employees without providing workers' compensation insurance, and you get caught by virtue of someone being hurt or killed on the job, that business is responsible for the medical costs and the indemnity costs related to a death if there is one, and you have appropriately provided us precious little statutory authority to be able to waive those fines or basically forgive them or anything like that, and those can mount, and they land on businesses and often business principals, and we have a lot of circumstances where the business has gone bankrupt. They can't discharge them in bankruptcy, but there's not an entity left that we're able to pursue for collection. So I think those are two of the most common reasons that you see balances at our agency.
Well, thank you. And I'll be interested in talking more about that. But mm-hmm. Chair Johnson, you've got the gavel.
I know you've opened the door, so I got to ask a question. Mm-hmm. In terms of, because banks fall under your purview, mm-hmm. in terms of a question about using financial institutions to help match identification, to help drive a more complete collection, I understand that banks are doing that now for child support as a result of federal legislation. In both as a former banker and now as a regulator in that industry, do you see that match as onerous, the match requirement?
You know, I have to confess to not being currently familiar enough with
That's
the current
fair.
Operational
That's
impacts
fair.
Of that to be able to comment intelligently.
That's fair. You didn't expect the question, and it's a bit esoteric. So anything else that you have for this part of your presentation?
No, but I'd be happy to stay in place if you'd like, if there are questions on the work session items.
Okay. I think we're now going to open up a work session. Might as well just stay there. So we'll close the informational hearing. On the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the report on the merger of the Insurance Division and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Mm-hmm. And we will open work session for three items: Building Codes Division, Workload Position Requests, Position Reclassifications, and Health Insurance Marketplace Fee Ratifications. And this time, I think I will turn to our professional staff from LFO. Do you have any comments, or do you want to dive right into it with Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I'd like to just
Please,
tee
welcome,
this one out.
I welcome your comments.
The Building Codes Division at the Department of Consumer Business Services is this first request. They're seeking to establish four permanent full-time positions. This ask includes an increase in their other funds limitation of $379,214. $219, and that's to fund these positions for the remainder of this biennium. My understanding of these positions is that one of them will be housed, a plans reviewer will be housed here in Salem, but the other three positions, who are all inspector positions, will be housed out of the Pendleton office. These positions, BCD did not have any expansion of their positions in their budget during the 15-17 budget cycle. This committee did authorize the conversion of limited duration positions to full-time permanent positions, but no expansion was contemplated during the budget cycle. So, although the agency has continued to have about 10% growth in their workload, and it looks like they're going to continue that 10% growth through the 16 and probably into fiscal year 17. So, with that, I'll turn.
Thank you. I might invite Mr. Long up just in case there are any questions for him. And while you're coming up, Mr. Allen, any comments?
Yeah, thank you. Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I would just refresh your memories. During the peak of the recession, the agency maintained across all of its divisions a large number of vacant positions. As work went away, we didn't fill positions. At a point in time, the legislature elected to remove those vacant positions but invited us to come back as workload rebounded to restore them to the extent that we were able to demonstrate that that was appropriate. This is continuing in that vein. It reflects not only our baseline workload level, but a shift in the nature and who's doing work in Northeast Oregon, which is why you see a focus of the positions where it is. And while I don't have the numbers across the agency, I can tell you that we're nowhere close to coming back to the staffing levels in like functions that we were when positions were eliminated.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions? Representative Woodson.
Well, actually, it's for Mr. Long.
Okay. Mr. Long, if you want to sign in, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. For the to get on the record, my name is Mark Long with the Building Codes Administration.
Thank you. I was just wondering on this information that I got, the permit activity for 2015 was 247,000 permits for construction. In 2016, it's 117,000. Is that actually since January 1st or January of this year?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative, these are fiscal year numbers, so
okay.
That reflects from July 1st to whenever we ran the data recently.
And Mr. Long, this may seem a little tangential, so forgive me, but I gotta ask. Talk a little bit about your current relationship with Construction Contractors Board. How's that going? There are many of us that have been pining. Senator Hansel just got back. Many of us have been pining for the opportunity to see greater collaboration, more cooperation. Could you just comment on that?
Sure, Madam Co-Chair. First, I'll start off. You may recall last legislative session, we worked with the Construction Contractors Board to seek legislation to allow us to collaborate in two basic areas, and one is on our licensing system. So my goal is to have a single place where customers can come in and do their licensing work and not have to go into our organization or the construction contractors organization. Just to give you a little bit of background, I license electricians and plumbers, essentially, and they license general contractors and other folks. We'd like to get that into one place. We're in the middle of the developing the RFP standards, Madam Co-Chair, and I anticipate sitting out there, and everything we're doing is set up so that CCB can come in and tag along with us once we get this thing set up. The other area we're collaborating is enforcement. We now are training their staff to look at things that we regulate when they're out in the field, and we look at things that they regulate when we're out in the field, again, to reduce duplication of effort and to make it a little bit more efficient out there and have a greater connectivity. So I think it's going well. It's never going fast enough for me, but that's just kind of you need to make progress, and we've been apart since 1973. And getting things to work back together is going to take a little bit longer.
Thank you for your leadership on that. Any other questions? I had opened the work session, and for the benefit of our colleague from Pendleton, perhaps Mr. Allen, you would just state again where these positions are going to go.
Yes, it's plan review position, Madam Co-Chair, in Salem, and then three inspector positions in our Pendleton office for work in Northeast Oregon.
Mr. Stainer?
I just need a motion.
I didn't know if you wanted to comment before we do the motion. The chair would entertain a motion to ratify the workload position requests. Co-Chair Gomberg?
I'm sorry, I was distracted. I distracted myself for a moment, Madam Co-Chair. Did you want me to move the...
We need the LFO recommendation.
Just for clarity. The LFO recommends the establishment of four permanent full-time positions in the Business Codes Division. And an increase in the other funds limitation of $379,219.
Madam Co-Chair, now that I've heard the LFO recommendation, I'd like to move it.
Thank you. Co-Chair Gomberg has moved the LFO recommendation, from the Chief Financial Officer.
We recommend approving Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Heath, for the record. I'm an analyst with the Chief Financial Office, and we recommend approving the request for four positions.
Thank you, colleague. Oops.
I'm sorry.
Are you done?
Yes, I'm done.
Okay. Colleagues, you've heard the motion and the recommendations. Any discussion? Any questions? Any objections? So ordered. All right. Next up, position.
Do you need a carrier?
No, because this won't go to full. All right. Next up, position reclassifications. Mr. Allen. Thank you, Mr. Long.
Madam Chair, if you might.
Mr. Stainer.
The agency has brought forth a request to increase our other funds limitation to accomplish some position reclassifications. Normally, this is done through what's called the permanent finance plan, where an agency makes puts and takes within their budget in order to change classifications, but doesn't change their budget expenditure limitation. In this case, the agency came upon a wall where that the puts and takes that they would have to make would have endangered their ability to maintain their ratio of non-supervisory employees to supervisory employees. So rather than putting that at risk, they're coming before you to request this increase in other funds limitation so that they can do the position reclassification without it.
Mr. Allen?
Patrick Allen, Department of Consumer and Business Services. I think Mr. Stainer got it. This is the kind of small bore stuff that we would ordinarily have managed in the ordinary course, but 4131 ultimately now causes us, I think, increasingly to bring these sorts of things to you.
All right, colleagues, any questions of Mr. Allen? Mr. Stainer, you want to give us the LFO recommendation?
Certainly. The Legislative Fiscal Office recommends an increase of $172,026 in other funds expenditure limitation to be included in the budget reconciliation bill.
Representative Witt, I would entertain a motion. I think the co-chair is distracted.
I would move the LFO's recommendation.
Thank you very much. Chief Financial Officer.
Good afternoon, Chair Johnson, members of the committee. Again, Patrick Heath with the Chief Financial Office. We recommend approving the request for other funds limitation of 172.
Don't stray too far away. We're about to do a vote.
We recommend approving the request of $172,026 in other funds limitation.
Thank you very kindly. Colleagues, you have heard the motion. Is there any discussion, any questions, any objection? Unanimous, so ordered. Thank you. Now you can go outside if you want.
Well, I'm supposed to sign the same bill that Gomberg's got. So oh.
All right. I already opened a work session on health insurance marketplace fee ratification. Mr. Stainer, will you tee us up?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. This last item for work session in front of you is the ratification of fees established by DCBS for the administration of the Oregon health insurance marketplace. These fees are the exact same fees that were established by Cover Oregon. In anticipation of the passage of Senate Bill 1 and with the passage of Senate Bill 1, the agency adopted these fees by rule. And according to statute, these fees need to be ratified by the legislature or they would be rescinded at the end of the legislative session.
Mr. Allen.
Patrick Allen, Department of Consumer and Business Services. These were inherited mid-process. We have now actually begun the fee-setting process under our own volition for the coming year. I would anticipate changes to those. But this is basically part of the pickup of the Cover Oregon work.
I think for the benefit of the committee, perhaps I'm just the slowest one up here, but could you talk a little bit about the magnitude of the fees?
Sure.
I think people are so hypersensitive right now to increases in any of the health insurance arena that if you could comment on that, that would be helpful for the committee and those listening.
Certainly. The marketplace is funded through a per-member, per-month charge paid by insurance companies on the policies that are offered through the marketplace. It's $9.66 per member per month on medical plans, 97 cents per member per month on dental plans. That equates to roughly about 2.9% of the total amount of premium. As you know, the federal government next year is going to begin charging a fee for the use of its platform, and so we're taking that plus reduced overall expenses and increased membership into consideration in setting next year's fees. But we anticipate to be somewhere in that 3 to 5% of premium range when you wrap federal and state charges all together.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions of Mr. Allen? All right. I've already opened a work session, so we're on our way. Mr. Stanton, would you give us the LFO recommendations, please?
Certainly. Madam Co-Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the fees adopted by the Department of Consumer and Business Services for both the 2015 and 2016 plan years be included in the fee ratification bill for your approval in full.
Chief Financial Officer, any comment?
Good afternoon, Senator Johnson, members of the committee. We also recommend approval of the fees for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace for the fee bill.
Co-Chair Gomberg, a motion.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. I would move those recommendations.
Thank you, colleagues. You have heard Co-Chair Gomberg's motion. Any discussion? Any question? Oops. Representative Whitson.
So we are talking about going from 2% to 5% of, in the future, a percentage of the premium. Is that correct that this represents?
Co-Chairs, Representative Whitsitt, that was a sneak peek at what I think will happen in the future. Today's action simply ratifies the existing fee that's 2.9% of premium. We'll be taking actions in the future that I expect to be well within the range of 3 to 5% and much closer to the 3%, including counting the federal fee that's not part of our budget. We'll have the opportunity to come back and talk to you in much more detail about that.
Madam Chair, just to clarify Director Allen's statement a little bit, the fee is not 2.9%. The fee is a per member per month fee, one for health insurance plans and another for dental standalone dental plans. And so the health insurance plan that was adopted, the fee was $9.66 per member per month, and the dental plan is 97 cents per member per month.
So
and those are the fees that are
it's
being.
It's not reflective of the premiums then. It is a set amount.
That's correct.
Okay. That's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was trying to equate it to give you a sense of the scale.
thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm to understand then that this fee then, this is just to pay the DCBS costs of this. So none of this $9.76 or whatever goes to the insurance company, nor does it go to a provider. It just goes to DCBS.
That's correct.
Thanks.
Okay. Colleagues, we have recommendations. We have a motion. Any additional discussion? Any other questions? Any objection? So ordered. All right. Mr. Allen, we are now moving out of the work session. I will close the work session on the three items, Building Codes Division Workload Position Requests, Position Reclassifications, and Health Insurance Marketplace Fee Ratification, and reopen the informational hearing, this time turning to building codes related to the Jordan Cove Energy Project, and invite Mr. Long to join you, please.
That's correct. That's correct. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Patrick Allen, Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'll just tee this up, and by your leave, I'd like to take off to attend to some other urgent matters. This really is in the same vein as the discussion we just had about adding positions back, and it's really the notion of, as our workload changes, we need to staff appropriately to deal with that workload. In particular, we're trying to be a bit anticipative of the possibility of a Jordan Cove project going forward. We don't have a request for you today related to that, but we want to be able to have you familiar with what our needs and expectations would be should that project materialize, because they really are quite significant, and we would have an ask because we would need to significantly staff to be able to deal with the workload that would be related to that. I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to Mark Long from the Building Codes Division, who will walk you through that.
Thank you, and if you'd like to excuse yourself, please feel free
Thank
to
you
do
very
so.
Much.
Mr. Long.
Again, for the record, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, Mark Long with Building Codes. And I think Director Allen teed this up perfectly, so I'll just kind of dive in. What I wanted to do is give you an overview of the project from a building codes perspective and what we're going to need to do from kind of a permit and inspection standpoint. As I've shared with many folks, that should this project go forward, I need to be in a position. I need about 6 to 9 months to staff up, get people adequately trained, because a project of this scale, scope, and complexity, we're going to have to bring in some pretty high-level individuals. And as I tell folks, our job isn't to get into if it should be put in Oregon or where it should be and all the other issues that are being reviewed by natural resource agencies. Our job is to let the public know it was done safely or not. That's fairly simple. So I'll kind of go through this quite quickly and see if there's any questions. First, just to get folks kind of familiar with the project, if you haven't seen it, this is down in the Coos Bay area, and this is looking north. And the first thing that we're going to be, and it's two projects. There's better slides of this, but there's the conversion facility over here, and then the generation facility over here, and it's about a mile apart, just so you get a sense of scale. Highway 101 is right here for those of you trying to get yourself oriented. The first thing that we're going to have to work on is the construction dock that's going to be put into water. It's going to bring in many of the pieces of heavy equipment. The contractors have a four-month window in which they can do in-water work. And so if they get approval, they're going to want to do that work this October through December, January, February. I don't want to speak for them. And so our issue is we'll need to make sure that we have folks that understand the complexity of putting in this large dock that's going to go in so then they can begin to do their site work. This slide just breaks up one of the two sites. This is the site that is what we call the conversion site. One of the interesting parts, this is where they're going to take the – it's going to come in as a gas. They're going to peel off some of the gas and do generation here. And then right in this area, they're adding an emergency responder station where they're going to have fire and police available on site and for the community as well. So
where is that, Mr. Long?
It's right here. This
– thank you.
This proposed building here. This is some of the generation equipment here, administrative buildings. I'm not exactly familiar with all the specific buildings down in here. I assume it's going to be some of the energy storage or energy facilities as far as because they're going to generate the electricity on site in this area. And then when you move back a mile to the other area, this is where they're going to convert it. I misspoke earlier, where they're going to convert it to from the liquid to the gas, cool it, compress it, store it, and then make it available for shipping, presumably overseas. So that's kind of the project. You'll see in the next slide. I don't know if you want to look at these pictures any more. You want me to bounce back? Any questions, Madam Chair, before I move off of the overhead?
Colleagues, any questions?
About the facility?
I think you can move ahead.
Okay. Just to give you a sense from our standpoint, the construction side of this for the areas that we regulate are within that site are $3.6 billion. It would be the largest construction project that we've worked on. It's has the two sites, as I mentioned, power generation, offices, emergency buildings, emergency responder, substation, all the kind of components I talked about. If you look at the work that we have to do, it's really kind of top to bottom from the seismic geosite hazard review to the engineer soil. They're going to be moving soil around, bringing things in, structural building seismic review, fire life safety, all your emergency systems, lights, exiting, sprinklers, mechanical. There'll be lots of mechanical piping, plumbing systems, the vessels, the containments, and then, of course, the electrical. In the next slide, this is just the overview of what we're anticipating from a workload based on 2014 data. And, of course, this will get updated as the project continues to go through its review process on the environmental side. We think we're going to have to look at about 10,000 drawings through those different categories. I'm going to want some engineers, and I'll talk about that. About 12,000, I guess I wouldn't say inspections. I wouldn't think of this in a traditional manner. It's really observations. We'll need to have our staff on site as the construction schedule is going and looking at key components to make sure we can verify it meets the state building code standards. We believe we're going to need about 8 positions for this, plans examiners, building inspectors, project manager, and the permit technician to kind of manage all the different contractors, all the different types of permits. If we were to do this as a traditional project, there are estimates that there could be upwards of 3,000 or 4,000 individual permits for all the different components. We're going to try to create a master permit, save administrative costs on our side for the contractor, for the customers, and again, try to manage this as a single project and get all of our inspectors organized so that they can go out and take care of the work that they need to have for the expertise that they need to have. When I look at the staff, and this is why I'm here, this is going to require a higher level of engineering and project management than for our typical work that we provide, primarily in rural Oregon, and some of the more sensitive projects we do up in the Portland area, like right now related to CLT. We could impact 2 to 3 biennium, depending on the timing. It's a 4-year project, so you could be in a 2 to 3 biennium, depending on the time of it. It could cross over. And again, as I mentioned, I believe I'm going to need 6 to 9 months before they need me to begin bringing folks in a kind of a phase setting to recruit, to train, and then get them adequately credentialed for the work that they need to look at. So the reason why I'm here is we want to be proactive. And again, once if the project goes through, if they meet all the other standards, we're going to have to ramp up quite quickly, and we're going to need to work with you, DAS, and staff to figure out a way to give us the ability to start the process in training and recruiting, because I anticipate these are going to be difficult to find, It's not always easy to find folks to live and work in our rural areas, as you all know. And so I'm kind of building into my timeline the potential for a failed recruitment or two, and I'm going to have to kind of bounce things around in order to meet the schedule. The last thing I'd want to do is hold up a project, especially when the customers have very narrow windows of construction time to get their work done.
Colleagues, any questions? Representative Whitsitt.
Taken into consideration the actual permitting and building of the pipeline as well. I mean, the majority of it goes through my district and Senator Whitsitt's district, and I didn't see anything about the pipeline itself. I'm just seeing a facility there.
Sure. Madam Co-Chair, Representative Whitsitt, my responsibilities for the site and kind of in our world, the Building Codes 101 is we're really on the kind of the non-utility side. We're on the private ownership side. So once that pipe, if you will, or power or other things kind of convert from the utility or the publicly owned side or in the right-of-way to the private property, that's kind of where we have. So we'll have soup to nuts for piping that's on that site that I showed you and all the building and related components. But outside of that is regulated by other entities, and I'm not sure. I believe that goes through some of the utility side. And that's the same as whether I'm sorry. It's the same as whether it's this Jordan Cove project or your house or a hospital or anything else. We kind of get on the site.
Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Mark. That was really great. If we go back to the one slide, it was $3.6 billion, I think. Yeah, right there. For permit purposes, what type of permit fees are you anticipating that you're going to receive? And will that be used towards, or can it be used towards the additional personnel that you'll need to bring on?
Madam Co-Chair, I was remiss in letting you know, yes, we are 100% fee supported, and the permit fees pay for the staff. Depending on how the project is, I'll give you what our best guess is, but it's going to change depending on how they submit. If you're familiar with construction, they'll draw up plans, they'll submit drawings to us, and then we'll calculate the fees accordingly. But we anticipate the fees to be anywhere on the low scale of $6 million to $10 million for the construction side of $3.6
billion. Okay.
And I know that's a big swag, but it's a big project with lots of variables as well.
I just appreciate your leadership in being this foresightful and in understanding that this is really servicing the customer. It doesn't matter what the subject matter of the initiative is, but it has been my experience today seeing agencies who really don't give a damn about the folks that they're regulating, and this time you're proactively enough looking forward to anticipate what are we as a professional, competent agency going to need to take care of this situation. And I very much appreciate the briefing. I appreciate the thought that's gone into it. And this was extremely helpful.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Any other comments? Senator Monroe. God, I'm sorry.
Do we have any knowledge of when, a timeline of when this decision will be made, whether to go ahead with this project? Some of us have been hearing about it for decades.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Monroe, the latest information I have, and I hate to confirm someone else's construction schedule because it's outside of my control, but they're hoping to get some of this activity, that dock construction in Q4 of this year to meet that window. If they don't get all their other permits ready and are able to proceed through that, I believe it's October to January, February. It has to do with fish migration. It's in-water work.
Okay,
if they don't get it done that year, then they'll have to wait for the whole following year to put that dock in, and that dock is integral to bringing in some of the equipment. So I assume that the folks that are working on this are trying to meet all the different regulatory requirements they're required to go through before they get to my shop. And the reason why I'm here is we're going to be approaching in another few months that 6 to 9 month window when I'm going to need to get staff to do that dock work and some of the construction. Then they'll go into site prep, and we'll have to get into the geotech reviews, get our engineers on staff, get up to speed. I mean, you know, this is on the coast, and so the seismic standards alone are very stringent.
Oh, yeah.
We need to make sure folks are up to speed on the issues.
Follow up.
Yeah, so it sounds like going to need to be a go or no-go within a couple of months.
From my standpoint, I think from the construction standpoint, they have time built into their schedule. You know, their needs are to get through the environmental reviews and to get their production construction schedule put together. My concern, again, is if you look at the level and complexity, is the recruitment training side. So that's why I'm getting here early. I really don't want this to be a fire drill, if you will, no pun intended, at just before a project started, where we're rushing in here for things we don't have our ducks in a row. I really want to make sure, for all the services we provide, that when somebody's ready for our services, yeah, we're ready to provide them in a timely manner.
Is it safe to say then you're starting to draft position descriptions now and working with the HR folks to get the recruitment mechanics in place?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And again, we're asking for high-level positions as well, so we're looking to bring in kind of the best and brightest and figure out what that right pay level is for a project like this. So I'm working on it, and I'll be working with all the folks here to try to put together a plan. And I wish I could say with certainty I'll be back in May or some other time, but it really depends on the other party. I'm ad-libbing here. We may have to figure out some way to, if you would be so kind to give me the green light to go forward and then pull back at the last minute or something like that, because I think that would be much easier than to wait till the last minute to try to go forward.
Let me just tee off of that and ask our professional staff. He said, give me the green light to go forward. This is noticed as an informational hearing only. I don't know whether or not you have discussed with the co-chairs or professional staff whether or not you wanted a go, no-go decision out of the 16 session to begin this work. Do you just want an articulation of the sense of the committee? I don't know exactly what you're looking for at this point. Mr. Stainer?
Certainly. Madam co-chair, members of the subcommittee, when this was brought forward by DCBS, we sat down and had a little discussion about the timing of it. And because there is this unknown quantity, there was an agreement between LFO and the agency that perhaps this wasn't the right time to ask for a vote of the subcommittee or approval to expend funds or to get the folks hired. And part of what came out of that was the agency and coming forth and saying, you know, well, we'd really like to discuss this with the subcommittee and explain to them what the parameters are and why we have this lead time. And we thought it was a very appropriate thing to bring in front of the committee. Now, there is still a very significant question of what is the time to actually go out and advertise the positions and try to get folks hired. And Mr. Long, myself, and the rest of the staff at DCBS will continue to look at that actively and bring that in front of the committee just as soon as it looks like we have a good agreement.
Absolutely.
Time.
Okay. And you're comfortable with that, Mr. Long?
Absolutely.
Okay. Senator Hanson.
Well, I guess it raises a question for me, bring it back before the committee, but if we've adjourned and the committee isn't meeting, how are we going to do that?
Madam Chair, Senator Hansel, the nice thing about the second year of the biennium is we do have the emergency board that meets fairly regularly. So what will happen is it will come in front of the e-board.
Well, I, again, applaud your leadership. I have watched several other agencies that were asked to do complex permitting, maybe not as complex as this, but from a review perspective, not ramp up and get absolutely overwhelmed. The rest of their work fell off the table. They weren't taking good care of the customer. And when we have a company that is looking at making the level of investment in our state, I think they deserve good customer service, and you certainly are preparatory to delivery. And so I applaud your foresight in doing that. Colleagues, any other comments or questions for Mr. Long?
I appreciate that, Madam Chairman. We also want to continue our great service in the other areas we provide as well. So that's how this kind
of
works.
You're a great
American,
Mr. Long. All right. Thank you. We will close the informational hearing on the COVID.
No. Generally, Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, I will say that DCBS will be back later on in the session. We've got a number of issues surrounding the health insurance marketplace that the agency is going to be being before this committee. It's a little unusual because of the passage of Senate Bill 1. Most of the presentation of the issues related to the marketplace have gone in front of the Health and Human Services Subcommittee, But since this is the subcommittee that oversees the budget of the agency, through this session, we'd like to bring them in and have them give you an overview of the marketplace, what's gone on so far, and bring this committee up to speed. And they're going to be doing that a little bit later on during the session.
Thank you. Colleagues, anything for the good of the order? We have concluded our agenda, and absent any comments from any of you, we stand adjourned. Absent any comments from any of you, we stand